Next week is the Thanksgiving holiday. And now that I've said that, your mind is probably off onto what the meal will be and what the table will look like. Perhaps you envision a scene right off of a Norman Rockwell painting, and there you are placing the perfectly cooked turkey on a perfectly clean tablecloth, upon which are placed perfectly placed forks, perfectly placed knives, which are about to be used in their proper order by smiling guests, none of whom are still in their pajamas. Tonight's lesson is on table manners. And now that I've said that, your mind is off trying to remember, where does the fork go, and is it the left or the right, and where does the napkin go, and when do you use the small fork or the big fork? In my house, we use the small forks when all the big forks are in the dishwasher. The concept of table manners normally includes managing forks and knives and spoons and all that kind of thing, but tonight's lesson will also talk about something like that. Tonight's lesson will also talk about knife placement. We're going to learn tonight about the necessity of taking a knife to your own throat for proper biblical table manners. Table manners normally include a word about chewing food with your mouth closed or not talking with food in your mouth, and tonight's lesson is going to talk about perhaps times when you shouldn't be taking that food in at all. But because we're in Proverbs, you're already probably correctly assuming that somehow table manners from the Scriptures are going to speak to spiritual issues, and they will. And Proverbs, like the rest of Scripture, manages the interaction of the material world and the spiritual world. So our lesson tonight will be spiritual, but we will also be thinking of material ways in which this lesson can be applied. We're always working in both realms, the material and the spiritual. Well, before we jump into the proverb that we're going to look at tonight, let's begin with a reminder of how the book of Proverbs itself tells us how to interpret itself. And I hope that you'll always, wherever you are in the book of Proverbs, remember that the book is always resting on a gospel foundation. And I think that is very clearly communicated to us in chapter 1, which begins with these words, the Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel. Now here's the point of the book. The point of Proverbs, the point of studying through this, is to know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, to the young man, knowledge and discretion. A wise man will hear and increase learning, and a man of understanding will attain wise counsel. To understand a proverb and an enigma, the words of the wise and their riddles. And then this very important verse 7, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. That is to say, the beginning and ongoing controlling, governing principle to the gaining of wisdom, the beginning and ongoing controlling principle of the increase of wisdom, the gaining and the increase of understanding and justice and judgment and equity and prudence and knowledge and discretion is the fear of the Lord, which has been defined before as the reverential submission to the God of covenant. Reverential submission to the God of covenant is the beginning and ongoing controlling principle for the gaining and the increase of wisdom. We study the Proverbs and we puzzle over them and we contemplate them and we learn to unravel these riddles and we learn to unravel these difficult sayings of the wise, always remembering the beginning and ongoing controlling principle, which is the gospel of grace. Our reverential submission to the God who is upon the terms of a covenant of grace. This is the ongoing controlling principle by which we interpret the book of Proverbs. right? The fear of the Lord. You hear that, and you need to think that God has condescended to us upon the terms of a covenant where the works of the covenant have been kept for us. Is that not amazing? Covenant has to be kept. No relationship with God upon the terms of a broken covenant. But this covenant has been kept for us, and it's received by us by faith alone, the benefits of it. The fear of the Lord is in the believing soul. And the fear of the Lord is thankful obedience, reverential submission in faith, reverential submission in obedience. So here at the beginning of the book of Proverbs, we're told that this isn't just a collection of sayings to help you find success in life, but is instead a book that will deal with your heart. It's a book that will bring diagnosis of illnesses of the soul. The book of Proverbs speaks not just to life, but it speaks to covenant life. Your life here and now in relationship with the God of grace. So, like I've said before, Proverbs is a Coram Deo book. Proverbs is about life lived in the home before the face of God. The book of Proverbs is about life in the marketplace before the face of God. It's about life in the workplace as a believer. It's about life as a church member before the face of God. It's about life as a child, life as an adult, life as a parent before the face of God. Therefore, this lesson on table manners is given to us to help sinners who have been saved by grace and who need instruction on growing in grace. That's what this lesson is about. It's not about keeping the works of the covenant because you can't. The works have been kept for you. The works having been kept, now we give our reverential submission to the God of covenant. And we revere Him in our faith and in our obedience. And we want to learn to be pleasing to Him in our obedience. And this is how this proverb will help us. All right, well, we're going to take a look at the first five verses of Proverbs chapter 23. Chapter 23, verses 1 through 5. They describe a table and a danger and a safe course of action. Here's what the proverb says. When you sit down to eat with a ruler, consider carefully what is before you, and put a knife to your throat if you are a man given to appetite. Do not desire his delicacies, for they are deceptive food. Do not overwork to be rich, because of your own understanding, cease. Will you set your eyes on that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away like an eagle toward heaven. Well, let's sit down at this table. Here is the table of a ruler. He is a man of authority. He is a man of success. He is a man of influence. His resume is impressive with prestige and accomplishments and perhaps well-earned respect. He is a man with dominion over land and people. He rules, and as you might expect, he enjoys the privileges that ruling pays for. And this ruler has invited you over for dinner. And so you arrive at his house, and of course you can recognize the success he has had in life by looking at his house. And you know how that happens. It happens all too easily within our own souls. We don't even have to work very hard at it, but you begin to do this mental comparison between your house and his house and his stuff and your stuff. And your house and his house look different. And you walk into his house and you say, wow, look at this nice thing, and ooh, look at that nice thing. It must be nicer than what I have. It must be better than what I have. How happy this man must be to have such nice things. This ruler has invited you to his house to eat at his table. And so you sit down at the table, and the meal is served, and the table is filled. And it's filled as you would expect a table like this to be filled. It is filled with the best tasting food. This is the finest food that money can buy. But before you can just dig in, the proverb tells you not to just dig in. It sounds the alarm. Now consider what it says. All right, consider it says, as you sit at this table, hold on a minute, Proverbs says, consider. It's the same word that I read earlier from chapter 1, verse 2. It's translated there as perceive. Know to perceive the words of understanding. And here this word shows up again as consider or perceive. Consider or wisely perceive. Observe with understanding and discernment. Wait a second, don't just dig in as you're at this table with the finest of delicacies. Consider, perceive, judge. Observe with understanding, rightly judge or rightly evaluate what is placed before you. Don't just start stuffing your face. Stop and think about it, the proverb is saying. Because there is some potential trickery at this table. There could be reason to be suspicious. There is the potential that you could be harmed. Now you say, well, how? How can I be harmed? Well, the proverb is saying that there's something deceptive about the food. So you hear the proverb. You're at the table and the proverb is sounding the alarm to tell you that that which has been set in front of you is deceptive. And so you know what your very first impulse is, right? Your very first impulse is to cast a suspicious eye on your wealthy host. What's he trying to do to me? But the proverb, you'll notice, does not tell you to do that. Your first reaction is to wonder, what sin is lurking in the heart of the host which has put you into a potentially dangerous situation? Except that the proverb does not tell you to do that. Your first reaction may be to defend yourself and to grab that properly placed knife and hold it out to keep that evil host from harming you. Except, you'll notice, that the proverb does not tell you to do that. Consider carefully, the proverb says. Consider carefully what is before you. Wisely discern and perceive the potential danger and grab that knife, yes, and have it at the ready, yes, only you must defend yourself by holding the knife to yourself. This act of self-defense involves you holding the knife to your own throat, which, by the way, is the same throat that was just about to taste all of those savory delicacies of the wealthy man. And then we notice that there's a condition here. You don't have to grab the knife unless you have an appetite problem. And so the alarm that's sounding in the proverb, the warning is this: be on guard against the deceptiveness of those provisions, especially if you have the tendency of falling for that deception. And take the necessary measures, it says, to slay that desire to believe that lie. Well, this is a strange saying, isn't it? This is a bit of a puzzle that we need to unravel. Very strange things that are going on here. So what does this strange saying mean? Yes, there is some trickery at this table. Yes, there is an illusion going on, but it's not intended by the host. The proverb doesn't lead us to think that. There is an illusion that your own heart wants to believe when you look at the host's savory food and abundant provisions. Your own heart wants to believe the lie that what is set before you and what you see and feel and taste is what will truly and lastingly satisfy you. Be careful, the proverb is saying. The host isn't trying to lie to you by giving you fake food or making it look like something that it isn't. The food itself is just food. That's all it is. But it's the nicest of food. Maybe nicer than what you have in your house. So the root of trickery here is in your own heart. The food itself says nothing, but if you are a person given to, or a person with a strong tendency to set your heart on those things, then it's your heart that's lying to you about what that food can really give you. All right, well, let's draw some lessons for ourselves. And to start this, let's give attention to some attentiveness to the illusion, and if you'd like, you can turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. And this will help explain to us this mysterious little riddle. Here's what the lie is that you need to wisely discern and be on guard against. The lie is that this is the real life, right? Or whatever that is on the plate, that this is what life is. This is the good life. This is the lasting life. The lie is this, that you can find true and lasting satisfaction with indulgence of the flesh at that table of the ruler. Now, have you ever tested this hypothesis? Yeah, it's okay to admit. You've walked with Christ long enough, and you're certainly old enough. Maybe you didn't intend on it, but you have certainly tested this hypothesis, maybe not with food, but you've tested it in one way or another. You've caught yourself putting your hope in things that are temporary, and those things disappointed you. And so you put that hypothesis to the test that there's this lie, there's this deceptiveness with things in this world. Well, Ecclesiastes chapter 2 is a great chapter, and it details an experiment. The preacher, and that's how we will refer to the writer of Ecclesiastes, the preacher decided one day that he would conduct an experiment. And he would conduct an experiment with his own heart. Now watch how the experiment goes. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you. There's the experiment. I will test you with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure. But surely this also was vanity, or like a breath. I said, laughter, madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh. And here's what's about to happen. He's going to indulge himself in every way possible to the extreme to see what happens, to see if he can find what he's longing for. I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom, so he doesn't lose his mind, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kinds. And so I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. Now, think about what he just said. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. For my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward from all my labor. And then verse 11. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done. I looked on all of the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed all was like a wisp of smoke. That's all he had left. What was the lasting result from all of his work and riches and gold and orchards and fruit trees and servants and singers and mirth and all of this? Complete indulgence. He completely gave himself to the indulgence of his flesh. And then he looks at what does he have after all of that? Indeed, all was vanity. It's like a wisp of smoke. It's like a breath. It was like grasping for the wind, he says. Imagine you're near the campfire and you reach your hand to grab the smoke and you don't have anything when you pull your hand back. He says, there was no profit under the sun. So here's his experiment, and there's the result of his experiment. More than anybody in this room will ever have. Completely gave himself to these things. He had resources to do that, and he did it. Grasping. And he was successful to grab things. He was successful to acquire the very best that this world can offer. But why does the preacher say that it was all ultimately like the wind, with no ultimate and lasting profit to him? He explains in verse 14. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceive that the same event happens to them all. Now, this is a pop your bubble Bible verse. He says he looks at the wise man. His eyes are in his head. He's perceiving. He's understanding things. The fool walks around in darkness, stumbling around. He doesn't know what he's doing. And then he says, for both the wise and the fool, the same thing happens to both of them. Now, what is that thing that happens to both of them? What is the same event that happens to all, wise and foolish, rich and poor? The answer in verse 15. So I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. And why was I then more wise than I said in my heart, this also is vanity? For there is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever. Since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. And how does a wise man die? Just like a fool. What is it that happens to all of us? Rich or poor? Wise or foolish? Death is what happens to all of us. In the end, the rich man with a lavish table and the poor man with a very moderate table, they both die with whatever was their last meal in their stomachs. They both die. And so you see, this man conducts an experiment and he relays the illusion that became very apparent to him. That at the end of it all, the illusion is this, that we don't want to believe, but here's an experiment to prove it. The illusion is this, is that at the end of it all, I will have something more than an empty hand. At the end of it all, I will have something different than you. I will have something more than smoke. I will have something more than ashes. We say this to ourselves sometimes. But what does this experiment in Ecclesiastes 2 reveal? It's just a lie. Yes, there is happiness, and yes, there is enjoyment to be had in the things of this life, but if that happiness is only in the things of this life, and if that satisfaction in your heart rises no higher in your heart than the food on the plate, then that satisfaction will pass like the food it is founded upon, all puns intended. If you have or when you have opportunity to enjoy the things of this life, the proverb is saying, be careful. There's nothing wrong with the invitation to go eat at the ruler's table. There's nothing wrong with the food in and of itself on the table. The proverb is saying, be careful, because there's this lie that your heart wants to believe. But the preacher in Ecclesiastes 2 is helping us here by saying, hey, I tried it. And I tried it more than you. I tried it to the extreme. I had pleasures and indulgences and riches that you'll never even dream of. And I came to the conclusion, I'm going to die just like a fool will die. I'm going to go in the ground just like anybody else is going to go in the ground, and I can't take any of this with me. So the proverb, chapter 23, is saying, be careful. Perceive. Look at that food with wise understanding. Perceive what's going on, especially perceive this lie, this deception. When you have opportunity to enjoy the things of this life, the proverb is saying, be careful. Be attentive to what you are setting your hopes on. If you are placed in a situation where it's the especially nice provisions of this life that are being offered or there, then be especially careful with what is the natural tendency in a human heart, which is to take the creature and put it in place of God. It's to worship and trust that provision rather than the provider. The proverb is saying, watch out, be careful, because this is a natural default for us. So the lie is this: if you can work that ground just a little bit harder than the next man, then you can outrun the dust. That's the lie. But you know what? You know what's true about dust? Dust is very patient. There's no anxiety in the dust. The grave has no anxiety. You can give yourself to a very anxious pursuit of the treasures of this world, and you can try to build a wall in between you and the inevitable end, but the end is inevitable. It is unavoidable. The grave knows that he can just relax. The grave will not get anxious. The grave knows that he has an appointment with you. And try as you might and eat as much broccoli and kale as you want to eat, you can't get out of that appointment. Surround yourself with as much gold and pleasure and happiness and savory food as you want. But the appointment with the grave is unbreakable. So is the conclusion, one of the conclusions of that experiment from Ecclesiastes 2. Try as you might, you can't get out of that appointment. Yes, says the preacher, go ahead and try it. Fill your belly and fill your heart with food. Yes, the preacher might say in Ecclesiastes 2, go ahead, stick your face fully into the plate of the delicacies of this life. Go ahead and do that, but you just need to remember something. Just remember that death is still there, tapping you on the shoulder with his little grin on his face. So one of the conclusions then of this experiment in Ecclesiastes 2 one of the conclusions was the ultimate futility of his labor to stockpile the temporary. All right, so why did I go into all of this in Ecclesiastes 2? Well, because it explains the result of testing the lie to see if it really is a lie. Right? The Proverbs 23 says this food, there's some trickery going on. There's something that can be very deceptive about it. There's a lie potentially there working in your heart. And Ecclesiastes 2 is saying, yeah, it's a lie. I've tried it. Right? That explains the result of testing the lie, and it proves that the lie is really there. And then you'll notice we're back now to chapter 23, Proverbs 23. And you'll notice now that the proverb includes this very same lesson. Do not overwork to be rich. Because of your own understanding cease, will you set your eyes on that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away like an eagle toward heaven. This is a bit of biblical humor here. There's a playful use of imagery. You may have a version that says something about your eyes alighting on it. All right? Literally, it's about your eyes flying to something like a bird. Right? Will your eyes, the proverb is asking, will your eyes fly down to grab that which is just an illusion? Will your heart be like a bird circling, spying, swooping down upon that which will only pass with its using and leave you empty again? Will you fly like a bird upon that which really is not? Will you set your heart upon, and will you set your highest hopes for lasting well-being upon the same things that the humble moth and rust can take away from you? Well, understand that warning. That which you might be tempted to fly to swoop down upon for lasting happiness, will itself, you notice what the proverb says, what will it do? It will sprout wings. You think you have wings swooping, gathering this. Well, that which you will swoop down upon to put your hope upon, why, it itself will sprout wings and it will be what is flying away. So the proverb says, because of your understanding, because of your wise perception, cease from filling your vision with an illusion. Well, now let's give attentiveness to appetite. Let's give attentiveness to appetite. The proverb has warned us about a lie or a deception or an illusion. Ecclesiastes 2 was very helpful to us to help us understand that. And now attentiveness to appetite. Well, what's true is that we have to use the things of this world. We do have to sit down and eat. So the root of this problem is not in the food. All right, so don't get too suspicious looking at what's on the plate. Look with understanding, but realize that you can't look at the plate and measure sin with a definite number of calories or carbs. You can't do that. You're not supposed to be doing that. All right? So that some lower number is godly and some higher number is ungodly. Where there's some kind of threshold where you cross from one to the next. The issue is not that poor provisions are godly and rich provisions are ungodly. That's not the point of the proverb. All provisions are from the Lord. Let us be thankful for how the Lord has provided for the ruler. The problem lies within our own hearts. It lies within our thinking. It lies within our perceiving, which are radically, that is, to the root, affected by sin. The proverb calls the alarm for attentiveness to our weaknesses as we sit to take in the food or any other necessary provision or any optional, non-essential delight. Attentiveness to your weaknesses at all times, but especially if you are in the presence of something where you are prone to forget that the lie is a lie or to believe the lie. You are being called by the Scriptures attentiveness to your appetite. Look upon your own heart, and especially do so if you are in a situation where you know that it'll be presenting to you a stronger temptation to believe the lie that has been disproven in Ecclesiastes 2. All right? It's calling for an ongoing, humble self-evaluation of the kind of temptations that tend to be successful against you. Do you know what those are? The proverb is saying if you are one given to appetite, well, do you know that you are? And in what situations are you? Humble self-evaluation, the proverb is calling us to this. The proverb is requiring attentiveness, a wise perception of the tendencies in your own soul. And you can certainly, or you must certainly rely upon special revelation. The Scriptures, they give you lots of information on how we will be tempted. And then even you gather information from general revelation. You have experiences that can be helpful to you, that help you to understand where you might be tempted. All sin is a danger to you, but some sins may be a greater temptation for you than others. And this proverb is calling you to be especially attentive to your tendency to idolatry. Isn't that at the root of this lie? Isn't that not at the root of this lie that your heart wants to believe about the delicacies on the plate there? It's a tendency to idolatry. It's a tendency to take some nice thing in creation and use it in an idolatrous way. So this requires you to study your weaknesses, attentiveness to appetite. It requires that you study your weaknesses, or to understand what are the situations or what are the things in this world that especially tempt you to idolatry. You are called to perceive if you are given to appetite. You are called by the scriptures here to perceive if you tend to struggle with corruption eruptions over certain provisions. So don't go to sleep in the presence of enemies. Be aware of what tends to try and ambush you, remembering that the root of sin is not in the substance but in you. All right, proper harshness. Proverb is calling us to this. Now we get to the knife. That properly placed knife that you've picked up and you have to hold it to your own throat. Well, it's a conditional statement in the proverb. If you are given, if you have a sinful tendency to use a thing sinfully, then take whatever measures are necessary to go to war against that corruption. That's what the proverb means. Take the necessary measures to guard yourself against that sinful temptation. From Matthew 5, here's how the Lord puts it. He doesn't use the word knife, but it's the same idea. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. It's better for you to just cut your throat rather than your throat indulge in this idolatrous pursuit. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you, for it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. Here's what Matthew Henry says about that passage from Matthew 5. What does this mean, this plucking out the right eye and cutting off the right hand? What does this mean? He says, this means to live a life of mortification and self-denial. He says, it means to keep a constant watch over our own hearts, and to suppress, listen to this, it means to suppress the first rising of lust and corruption there, to avoid the occasions of sin, is what this means. It means to resist the beginnings of it, and to decline the company of those who will be a snare to us, though ever so pleasing. It means to keep out of harm's way. It means to abridge ourselves in the use of lawful things, that we may have to do that. You may have to limit yourself, depending on how you are tempted in particular ways. Always recognizing that the root of it is in your own heart and not in the thing itself. All right, now for our conclusion. Wisdom displayed. If you'd like to turn to Psalm 104, I'd like to give you an example. Here is a believer who will display to you the wisdom that we have been thinking about tonight. I'm going to jump in just for the sake of time at verse 10. He has been just reveling in God's provision for the world. God provides for all of these different creatures. He provides for them in all of these different ways. And the psalmist is just in this state of delight and joy as he's looking out over his back porch and just all of the ways that God has created things and provides for things. So verse 10, he sends the springs into the valleys. They flow among the hills. They give drink to every beast of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst. By them the birds of the heavens have their home. They sing among the branches. He waters the hills from his upper chambers. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of your works. He causes the grass to grow for the cattle and vegetation for the service of man, that he may bring forth food from the earth and wine that makes glad the heart of man, oil to make his face shine, and bread which strengthens man's heart. God provides and God sustains his creation. And then the psalmist thinks of the wine and the oil and the bread, this threefold repetition. And notice how he describes the benefits that come to him. And their effects upon his soul. This face, he eats bread and it makes, or he has oil to make his face shine. It changes the countenance on his face. He's not rubbing oil. This isn't a cosmetic effect, right? He has this oil, maybe the finest of olive oil. He's dipping his bread in it and just puts this countenance of joy upon his face. Why? Because he knows who has given him the bread and the oil to enjoy. He has this food on his plate in front of him, and his heart is going to the Lord, isn't it? Isn't it interesting how, and it's what we would expect, it's what we know, that the wild donkey doesn't have any of this. He has water and he quenches his thirst and he has his food and his instincts are driving him and they're satisfied by this water and this food, but there's no gladness in the heart of the donkey. He eats and he's full. That's it. But the psalmist eats. He enjoys the wine and his heart rejoices. Why? Because he thinks of his Creator who is providing for him. So, this is an interesting observation, I think, how the psalmist is describing material provisions, oil and bread and wine, and he does not describe the benefits to his body. Certainly, there are benefits to eating, but he describes these soulish effects. And it's not that food is a means of grace, but he looks at his food in one hand, with the scripture in another hand. He's applying the truth to his food. And he knows who has provided this food, and his heart is glad with the truth thereof. In verse 30, in that same psalm, he says, "You send forth your spirit. They are created, and you renew the face of the earth. May the glory of the Lord endure forever." Now, that sounds interesting, doesn't it? Because what does the lie say to us? The lie that we're warned about in the proverb, the lie that we're warned about in Ecclesiastes 2, the lie says that will last forever, right? Give yourself to that. This is what will last forever. This is the happiness that will last forever. No. You see what the psalmist is saying? He's not saying that. He's saying what? May the glory of the Lord endure forever. May the Lord rejoice in his works. He looks on the earth and it trembles. He touches the hills and they smoke. I will sing, not to the oil, I will sing to the Lord as long as I live. I will sing, not to the wine and not to the bread. I will sing to the Lord as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have my being. May my meditation be sweet to him. I will be glad in the Lord. Now, the preacher in Ecclesiastes 2 conducted an experiment. He said, I wanted to find out if I could be glad in all my stuff. And I gathered more stuff than anybody has ever gathered before me. And I discovered that there's no gladness in it. So look at the psalmist and look where he has discovered lasting well-being, lasting gladness. Even as he has these delightful things on the plate and he's taking them in, All right, so let's conclude with this application. We're thinking ahead maybe even to our Thanksgiving meal. For what is God providing when you have that plate and cup in front of you? How is He taking care of you? Well, I would propose that you think about this during your Thanksgiving meal. The Lord is providing for you body and soul. Your table may be a little bit more full than it normally is for a Thanksgiving feast. Look at that spread and think to yourself how good God is to take care of you body, but also to give you some things if you don't believe the lie, if you're cautious like the proverb says, you recognize the deceptiveness and you're turning away your heart from that, you look at that food, you're not going to believe the lie that it'll give you lasting happiness, but you still look at it and you say, Lord, thank you for your goodness. So I don't want you to come away tonight thinking, mealtime, if I'm going to be godly at the table, this is going to be a miserable experience, right? Just, I've got to look sad and I've got to, no, not at all. The psalmist wasn't sad at all at his table. He was filled with delight and filled with joy, not because he believed the lie, but because his heart was turned to the generosity and the goodness of his provider. So enjoy the meal with gladness of heart. Enjoy it with cheerfulness in your countenance. Enjoy it with this strengthening in your inner person as you contemplate the truth. And it's not because food and drink are our gods, and it's not because a turkey dinner is a means of grace, but because we can apply the truth to that moment at the table. Yahweh is our Elohim. And He condescends and reveals His power and reveals His greatness and reveals His honor and reveals His magnificence in not only what He has created, but in what He sustains. And He reveals those things and how He sustains us. So, the fear of the Lord is the beginning and the ongoing controlling principle for the wise perception and understanding and use and management of our lives. So we sit at the table, maybe sometimes even at the table of rulers, with our hearts reverentially submitted to the God who has condescended to us upon the terms of grace. So look at those good gifts and thank Him and praise Him and be delighted in Him as you enjoy that food and drink next week.